Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is Monsters Who Murder, Serial Killer Confessions. With Amanda Howard and Robert McKnight.
Hello there and welcome to Monsters Who Murder, Serial Killer Confessions. I'm Rob McKnight and there's no surprise here, but I am joined by the serial killer whisperer herself, Amanda Howard. Hello, Amanda.
Hello, Robert. It's been a couple of days between episodes, but I'm glad that we're here and we're doing it once again.
Indeed. We love doing it and in the nicest possible way. Amanda, you know, in a few days' time, it's the anniversary of your husband's suicide.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, the episode that you've come up for this week. It's reflecting on some philosophical themes. We're going to go on a very different tangent this week to do with death and family.
Yeah, so we're going to have a look at not the killers themselves, but we're actually going to talk about their families and those that have often appeared in the interviews with police with the person that's been charged, as well as press interviews that have gone ahead when the news is very, very raw. So it's looking at how people handle what has happened to someone they love, but also what has happened to their entire family, because, you know, we often look at these cases in isolation, just looking at the killer themselves. But in this one, we're actually going to go beyond that. And it just shows how things like this can actually change a person's life.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating episode. And look, Amanda gave a very raw and honest interview on the first anniversary of her husband's death. There was a lot of drinking involved as well.
Yeah.
And that episode is still available on the free service, so you don't need to go to Patreon or anything like that. It's the first episode. It's episode 8, where I would really recommend listening to that, but make sure you've got tissues with you, because it's an amazing chat and Amanda really opened up, and we've left it there for good reason. So anyone who can relate or wants to hear the other side of dealing with death, it's a fascinating listen. And don't forget to reach out to the many organisations around the world if you are feeling down or depressed about the state of affairs or loved ones that have died or anything like that. There's a lot of services around the world to reach out for. In the meantime, let's get into the news. And there are new reports the alleged Golden State killer is going to cut a plea deal. CBS News 13 has more.
The suspect, Joseph D'Angelo, is expected to admit to the crimes in a plea deal to spare him from the death penalty. Prosecutors are holding the hearing in a large ballroom at Sac State, large enough for the victims, families, and the media. The former Auburn police officer has been behind bars since his 2018 arrest.
Amanda, I do believe you called this a long time ago.
It seems to be the way that these cases go these days, that it's easier to cut a deal and then the costs go down, because, you know, these cases, like we're seeing with the Claremont case, they can go for years. And so the fact that it looks like that they're going to cut a deal, which is going to take the death penalty off the table, he will get a better lifestyle in prison than if he was on death row. And it's just something that I think was going to be inevitable. And it's
Amanda? Why? Because there are a lot of people being hurt by this guy, if he is indeed the guy. And let's assume innocence until he's proven guilty, of course. So if the prosecutors have the evidence, why wouldn't they go full force and get the full power of the law? Why should he get comforts in jail?
Well, it's not exactly about the comforts in jail. It's more about that they know that they're going to put him in jail. It's so because it can come down. I've seen cases that have gone to the very last second and then the jury has come back and said, no, it's not enough.
So they just don't want to take that chance.
Exactly. And with a case like this, all it takes is one little thing that the defence will question that can put that seed of doubt in a jury or judge's mind. And so then they actually go to a point saying, well, if this piece of evidence might not be real, how about everything else? And because it comes down to reasonable doubt. If there's one point, that is enough. And when you're looking at such a grand case as this one is, it is a lot of wheels that have to turn. So it's better, as you said, it is better for D'Angelo, if he is the killer, to take the plea deal because he will get an easier life. But it's also, it means to other families that he will be going to jail and they don't have to sit through all of this stuff and having their families dragged through the mud or the ridicule that sometimes come, victim shaming, all of that, it's gone. It's taken off the table. He goes in and says guilty and he goes to a better life in prison. In a lot of prisons in the US, there is a harsher life in certain areas, and especially death row. They aren't allowed to associate with other people. They get shackled every time they have to leave their cell. They're in their cell for longer and all of that. So if he's put into an area, he'll probably still be in protective custody. But if he's in Gen Pop, it's going to be easier for him to sort of get around and do things, especially as an older man. But as I said, he will be in protective custody, but he will be in an easier protective custody than he would if he was on death row.
What do you mean, victim shaming?
Well, there's never a case that goes forward that they don't sort of question the families. Now, a lot of the time there is people that come forward and say, well, if this person wasn't walking down this street at 3 a.m., you know, they wouldn't have been grabbed and stuff like this. Now, D'Angelo went into the homes and so it's different, but these people have to then go through each detail that, you know, the strangulation, the stabbings, the ridicule that they actually endured before they were killed. They don't have to go into that because they've already been there and it's basically just taking that scab off a wound that is trying to heal.
Gotcha. Okay, a man in India dubbed Cyanide Mohan has been found guilty of the rape and murder of a young woman. This is the 20th and last of the murder cases registered against the criminal who has killed several women using cyanide after befriending and raping them. Amanda, tell me about this guy.
It's weird that they keep coming up with these names in India because Cyanide Mohan is just sort of the next one from Cyanide Malika, who is one of the world's worst serial killers, and she did similar things to what he has. And they are able to get cyanide quite quickly. So what they do is they find people that they believe are vulnerable, abduct them, take them away, promise them the world, and then they're actually... In this case, they're raped before they're being poisoned. So it's weird that in a world where we no longer use cyanide and it's hard to get in India, it seems to be right there and ready to use. So it's amazing that this country keeps having poisoning. They keep having serial killers that use poison.
Amazing. All right. Well, now to an update on a story we brought you last week. Michael Bear Carson has been denied parole and will have to wait 10 years until his next hearing. The serial killer was known as part of the San Francisco Witch Killers after a crime spree in the 70s and early 80s. Carson's daughter has long opposed his release. Amanda, this strikes me. Why does his daughter want him to stay behind bars?
Well, it's quite interesting that we're doing this news article compared to what we're doing for this week's case. But she believes that he is just as dangerous and just as horrible as his victims do. So she believes that if he actually gets out, he will kill again. And she's already had to deal with that entire life, knowing that her father is a serial killer, that she doesn't want to then have to relive that again if he gets out and it's a... It could be just, you know, a couple of weeks, couple of months before he kills again. So she's there with the victims and the victims' families to hopefully deny his parole, which we've seen has happened.
Fascinating because, you know, a lot of times the family will get behind the killer because they love them and they care for them. But this is a really interesting stance. It really struck out at me. Well, first it was Harold Shipman and now Osama bin Laden has turned up in the crowd of a football game. English soccer fans caught sight of the dead terrorist leader during a Leeds United game. With crowds not allowed at matches due to the coronavirus crisis, leagues around the world have been using fake fans so stadiums don't look completely empty. Ah, Amanda, the games continue.
Oh my God, this is so funny. I know it's horrible, and I know that he's responsible for thousands of deaths.
Yeah, but it's just,
it's just quirky. It's just, you know, there's people out there with gallows humour, and I appreciate them, and I wish that they would contact me because I need to be their friend, because I find this just so morbid and dark that it is beyond that. It's just so funny, and I like their sense of humour.
It is. Look, I agree. It's not that big a deal. It's just, it's people being stupid and funny, and it doesn't represent, it's not an indication that anyone approves of what he did.
No, it's just, I don't know. I wish I had that thought process. I would make a whole section of all of these various serial killers from around the world just to see what it would look like. But this is amazing, and I'm glad that they've done it.
You've sort of done that in your room. What are you talking about?
Yeah, my office looks a bit that way.
I can see John Gacy behind you.
Yeah, there's Fred Deeming and Zodiac and Albert Fish, but I can understand that Harold Shipman got through because he does look like someone's dad.
Yes.
But Osama bin Laden, there is no one in this world who doesn't know what he looks like.
No one putting it. Someone, you've got to remember, someone actually has to place it in the seat, right?
So someone has to approve it. Someone has to cut, send it to the printer. Someone has to cut it out. Someone has to put it in a chair.
And no one went, we've got Osama bin Laden here.
Oh, what a crack up.
Maybe the US didn't get him and Osama bin Laden's hiding out at Leeds Football Stadium.
I love a good conspiracy,
that. Absolutely. All right. Coming up in a moment, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're looking at the families of serial killers and how they deal with their horrific acts. And don't forget, you can join our Patreon fan group at any stage simply by going to patreon.com/MWMconfessions. And you can even just donate here. You just a few dollars our way, a cup of coffee's worth just to keep the podcast going. In the meantime, we'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ben, Robin, Robbo. Media executive Rob McKnight.
Something brand new is coming to your social media feed.
Big Brother winner Ben Norris.
This is something bold and informative with a side of humour.
And journalist David Robbo Robinson.
It's truly going to be something different.
The Ben Robin Robbo Show starts April 20. Go to tvblackbox.com.au/BRR for more information.
It's the Ben Robin Robbo, Ben Robin Robbo Show, Robin Robbo Show.
Well, this week we're doing something very different. The maxim says blood is thicker than water, but does this still ring true when you find out a family member is a killer? How does someone reconcile the thoughts that the person they love is a cold-blooded murderer? Amanda, what can we expect in today's episode?
Yeah, we have talked about the families of killers before. I remember when we did the John Wayne Gacy episode, his sister was on a lot of it, and Ted Bundy's mum and all of that, and we do try to comprehend how they must feel, and we do see a range of emotions from a lot of them. We do see the hatred, we do see the disappointment, we do see the confusion. But this time we're actually going to look at something different. We're going to look at those that are still there to support their family, those that have to sort of negate their own thoughts and just be there. So it's a very different point of view that we're going to look at, and we're not going to profile the families. It's not fair for them to have to go through that sort of spotlight, but we're just going to go through their emotions and how they must be feeling without sort of saying, this is what they're thinking, this is their body language or anything like that. This is just about how they have coped with what has happened.
Yeah.
Because a lot of them are ostracized and shunned purely because of the crimes of their kin.
Yes, they've been tarred with the same brush, that's for sure. Okay, let's get into the first case, that of school shooter Nicholas Cruz. This is the one that inspired you to do this episode. Can you give us a bit of background?
Yeah, well, 19-year-old Nicholas Cruz was the school shooter who went into Stoneman Douglas High on February 14, 2018 and opened fire. Now, he killed 17 people, so students and teachers. And the event was actually a major catalyst that I thought would bring around gun reform in the US. A lot of the students said that they would refuse to return to school until something was done. But besides all of that, Cruz was interviewed for 10 hours, and we will be doing that as a case later on. But about halfway through the interview, he's sitting there in scrubs. He's got his hands handcuffed behind his back because he had been tearful and quite suicidal. And the officer says that he cannot uncuff him because he was sort of scratching at his arm and trying to harm himself. But Cruz actually asked for the interviewing officer to bring his brother, Zachary, in to talk to him. Now, Cruz was adopted, and his adoptive parents had died. So basically, Zach is the only family he has, and they're both from different races. So Nicholas Cruz is white and Zachary is black. So we're seeing a whole different sort of family dynamic here, and it is just heartbreaking.
Well, this is what happened when Zach was brought into the interview room.
I did talk to Zach. He's right here. Okay, well, listen up though. If you want to talk to Zach because of some of the things you said, I'm going to have to sit in the room. I'm not going to talk to you. I'm not going to ask you any questions. But I can't leave you two alone because some of the things you said about harming yourself.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk to Zach?
Yes.
Okay, Zach, have a seat. And again, I'm not saying anything at all. So.
What do you think Mom would think right now?
She would cry.
She would cry. You're people think you're a monster now.
A monster?
You don't have anything, and you're not acting like yourself. Like, why? Like, we've. This is not who you are. Like, come on. Why did you do this? This is. Don't even laugh. Dude, this is.
I'm sorry.
I try to. What happened to your Instagram? I tried to text you, like, literally a couple of days ago, because I had this bad feeling in my heart. What happened to your Instagram? Why did you text me? Or what happened to it? Why'd you stop with your social media?
People.
What do you mean people, dude? Is irrelevant people. What? Who? Tell me exactly who. Who made you delete your Instagram? Who?
People.
What people?
People. Don't.
Do you think this is not even a game? You're not gonna wake up and be out of here.
I know.
You remember when we were in the hospital and I told you I had your back? Remember when Mom died? Remember we were walking down the hallway and I told you? You don't remember. You probably don't because you just did some fucked up shit. I told you when we were walking down the hallway that it's just me and you and I had your back. Alright, I know you probably feel like you have nobody, but I care about you. I literally would pour my heart out for you. I know I make it seem like I didn't care about you at all. I know I made it seem like when we were growing up that I hated you, I didn't like you. But truth is, I just didn't want to look like, I didn't want to look weak. I love you with all my heart. Like, I will tell you, I'm telling you right now, I love you. All right, I know what you did today. Other people look at me like I'm crazy for even. And I don't care what other people think, like, you're my brother. I love you. I want you to. You can't. Why are you?
Amanda, Zach was only 17, 2 years younger than Nicholas when the massacre occurred. Yet here he is, the voice of reason to his adopted brother. You know, no one would blame him for hating Nicholas. Most of the world at that moment, and probably to this day, hates Cruz.
Yeah, and yet there is Zachary. He sits there face to face with his brother, and as we heard, Nicholas is actually sobbing his heart out throughout this. But Zach's words become more powerful the longer he actually speaks to his brother, because he knows that he is the only person in this world that can't hate Cruz at this time. So Zachary just sort of, he melts your heart. He really does.
Yeah, then Zach turns to the officer in the room and asks a question that will break your heart.
Can I hug him?
Yeah, as long as you...
I mean...
I'm sorry,
baby.
I love you.
Yes, I love you too, bro. I know what you've gone through, though.
I'm sorry, baby.
That's okay, bro. I know how you grow up. I know that people don't understand you, but I understand you.
I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't.
I love you.
You don't know what you want to do with your life. You didn't know what you wanted to do with your life. How do you not know what you want to do with your life? You talk about the army.
I know.
You talk about. I think that's really it. I mean, you never really told me about how you want to do with your whole life. Why would you jeopardize that? Like, you can't even own a gun now. I mean, it's not even about the gun. I don't know why I'm talking about that. You're only 19, dude. Do you know how many years you had ahead of you? You know how many years you had? Years! You're still stuck in your teenage mindset and you did this dumb shit. You're not thinking about your future.
I still care for you.
What? I still love you.
I still love you too.
Bro, like, I mean, I wish I could have prevented this. Because I feel like this is a big part of, like, my fault also. Because, you know, we grew up together. Like, I know I was the nicest to you. I know I probably made you feel like shit. And you told me that, I'm pretty sure that you told me that I made you want to kill yourself or something. And I'm sorry that I grew up being a dumb jerk to you and made fun of you and didn't want you to hang out with my friends even though there's nothing wrong. Like, I think about it, like, I don't even know how to talk right now. You can't even see Kobe anymore or Maisie. And that's what you would text me, you'd be like, oh, how are Kobe, how are Maisie, and they're good. Like, dude, you had me, though. I even cried, dude. I think I've thought about, like, you killing yourself, and I cry about it. And by myself, I think, damn, like, this kid, like, if he killed himself, like, I'd feel like shit, because this is my brother. Like, I love him.
I'm a failure, dude.
I mean,
no question about it.
Nah, dude, you're lost. You're not in your head. Like, you're not with yourself. I feel like you're caught up in something in your head. You're not right in the head. That's for sure. You're not right in the head.
I'm so conflicted when I hear this, Amanda. We got Zach there blaming himself. We got a kid who has massacred people, and yet, especially when you see the video, see the way he's chained up, see him crying like a lost puppy, I have sorrow for him, and I can't reconcile the two thoughts that you little shit to take these lives, and then I feel immense sorrow for him. I can't ever understand of what it would be like to be the family of the sibling of a serial killer, but I feel like seeing this kid, I get some sense because it's such a confliction in my mind.
Just a place that, you know, I almost found this tape accidentally because I found a cut of just some of this and then I found the full 10-hour interview. And this poor 17-year-old kid is just standing there in front of his older brother. You can tell that they had a weird dynamic growing up that, you know, that Nicholas was sort of the dorky kid, you know, a bit special, you know, just sort of need a different sort of environment. And Zach Saint seems to be the cool kid who had the cool friends and
he wouldn't Nicholas have had knew. Anything to do no. with him, you know that. And he sort of admits that in there that he didn't treat him well, you know. Yeah. So he's obviously taking on a lot of guilt for this.
Yeah, and I mean, for Zach, he even actually says in this tape that he promises Nicholas that he's going to go to court every single day. And this poor kid, he did. He went every single day. And even according to the Washington Post, Zach didn't even own a suit and he had to actually go and borrow some so he could wear suits to the court and so he could go in and sit close to his brother, you know. But what effect this has on Zach after all of this is that he actually got ostracized by his community. He got kicked out of home. He actually ended up with mental health issues himself, and he's been in hospital several times, and he's been arrested twice as well. So, you know, this is that butterfly effect that is starting to happen. This poor 17-year-old boy who's lost his parents too, and his adopted brother has now gone and killed people in the deadliest school shooting in American history. We have to remember that as well. Yeah. And Zach is the only person that Nicholas can talk to. And he's basically taking on that role of parent. You expect him to say any moment, "I'm not mad, I'm disappointed," because that's the tone he's using. He wants to say, "What the fuck, what did you do?" But he knows that he needs to be there for his brother and he needs to comfort him regardless of the heinous crimes that he has done. You know, but nothing will ever be the same. And Nicholas realizes that. I mean, as Zach said, you know, you're not right in the head, and it's an easy way to justify what happened, you know. But then Zach finds out that he's not right in the head, just to use his terms, and ended up in a mental institution himself. But that's not what he means. What he means by that is that your thought processes change and something created this. And so he's trying to find things that maybe if I loved my brother more, he might not have done this. And that's a horrible thing for a 17-year-old boy to have to try and work through.
Mm. Well, look, then he changes the conversation.
Remember those days when we go to the pool?
Yeah.
And we talk going there and walking back about crazy shit. Like, I like hanging out with you, dog, but you know, like, we have different, like, thought, like, we didn't really, like, I don't know, we do different stuff. That's why I wasn't always there. You know, I like to skate, you like to, guns, you like guns. That's all I knew. I didn't feel it like that. I was like, I mean, I don't even want to leave. I want to stay here with you, but I can't. I can't, dude. I want to talk to you. Like, I would love to just talk to you one on one without anybody. Like, I wish you could just get up and walk with me and go walking, but no. You can't talk. You can't do none of that.
All right, well, like I said, I gave you guys some time together.
Thank you.
No, I understand that. No,
I'm gonna come to your trial. I'm coming to everything. All right, I'll come see you whenever I'm allowed to. I will have everything. I swear to God, every time I have the chance to see you, I will come see you.
Thank you.
I swear on everything I love, I will come see you every chance I am given. All right, no matter what happens, I'm gonna come see you. All right, I'm gonna come see you. I care about you. All right, I'm gonna come see you. All right. I promise, I'm gonna come see you every time. I care about you, all right? I care about you, dog. Like, I hope you know.
I care for you.
You really messed up this time. Like, at a point where, like, it's not even, like, a joke. It's not. No one can get you out of this, dog. Like. I'll have another conversation with you another time, all right? Like, I'll try to talk to you, all right?
Like I said, I'll let you guys talk privately, but, you know, his concern
just,
to me was...
Just stay solid, all right? Just don't hurt yourself, all right? All right? So just live your life, all right? Please, do not kill yourself, all right? You're given one life. Like, you don't understand. I don't think you understand that. You're given one life. You only can live one time. All right, don't just end it because you don't like how it is. Live your life, see how it is. Even if it's gonna feel hopeless, if it feels hopeless, you just gotta push through, dog. That's all I can tell you right now. All right.
Okay.
All right, Zach. Cool.
Shit. Do you see? I have to go. I literally can't stay here with you. Like, I want to stay here with you. I don't want to go with this. I don't want to go back out there. All right. And people are crazy out there right now. I do not want to go back out there, but I have to.
Okay.
Alright, I'm gonna come see you, bro. Please, don't forget, alright?
Okay.
When you're feeling hopeless, think about me, alright? I love you. I believe
good things. You're gonna have the chance to talk to him on the phone. They have phones and everything over there and everything else. So once he gets situated, he can call you.
Just stay solid, alright? Be strong. Be strong for me, alright? If you're not, if you're not for yourself, remember, think of me. Be strong for me, please. Because I love you. I don't care about anybody else in my life right now. I don't care about skateboarding. I don't care about nothing. I don't care about being cool. I don't care about none of that. I only care about you right now, all right? I don't care what people think about me for thinking that I love you and I care about you. I don't care what nobody thinks. I care about you. I care about you. I don't care what other people think. I just want you to know that I love you, dog. Like, I really do. Like I feel like I had a better bond with you than Mom. Like...
Zach really has the weight of the world on his shoulders. He's being held accountable for his brother's action. He's also trying to stop his brother from killing himself and talk him up. What a hard position to be in, Amanda.
It is, and that's why he is repeating himself, because there's no words. There's nothing, regardless of the support and love he has for his brother, nothing can change what's happened, and he has that weight of the world on his shoulders. You know, he just keeps saying, you know, I love you and I'm going to be here for you. And really that's all he can do. You know, Cruz had to go into, lockdown and make sure that he didn't kill himself. And it's just horrifying for this young boy that has to take on his brother's crimes, essentially. And, you know, I just want to hug Zach. I just want to tell him it's okay and just sort of adopt him and take him as my own, purely because this kid is an innocent in all of this, regardless of if he was mean to his brother. Everyone's mean to their brother. I mean, that happens, but that's not why he went and did one of the most deadliest shooting in American history. And so poor Zach, he just has to live his life knowing that he's the brother of that killer.
Yeah. Well, look, moving on to the next case, and this time the details and the discussions are very different. Chris Watts, the man who murdered his wife and two daughters in August 2018, asks to speak to his father during the second day of interrogations. Here's how it starts. Watts has failed the polygraph and is crying. His father sits close to him. They're left alone in the room.
Hey, Chris, we're going to let you have however much time you need, okay?
Sure. Can you leave us in here? No.
Yes.
Okay.
I know. Tell us how long you've been here.
It's polygraph. Failed it.
Yeah, because there's too much emotions.
They're not gonna let me go.
Is there any reason why they shouldn't?
What's my pain? They know I had an affair. And they know. I can't complain about that.
They know you had an affair.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else you want to tell me? What's going on, or what happened, or anything? Do you know anything about?
When we had that conversation that morning, it was emotional, and told her about separation and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
what happened after that?
I'm
So Watts tells his father he had an affair and believes he is about to be arrested. It must be so hard for his father.
Well, yeah, I mean, the emotions are all over the place, and his dad's just trying to sit there and be supportive, you know. He tries to negate the polygraph, saying, yeah, but, you know, there's lots of emotions going on. You know, he's believing he's sitting with his son who has just lost his wife and children. He's not believing that his son is a killer. So,
oh, I know you want to dive into this now, but we are doing a full profile on Watts in a later episode. So let's continue with the recording. Watts confesses to his father, but it's a lie.
I don't want to protect her. What? I don't want to protect her. You don't want to protect me. I don't know what else to say. She hurt him. Yeah. And then I'm telling her. Well, no, I'm telling her. You're her. Did they leave after that for a long time? So she started hurting the kids.
Amanda, there's a lot of silence in there.
Yeah, I mean, this is so hard to not profile. and it's really frustrating that we can hear the clock louder than we can the actual people in the interview. But anyway, but there seems to be a distance between the two men. Now, this is almost quite typical of what we see in an adult male and his father. So, you know, there is that toxic masculinity sort of playing a bit here. You know, but he's actually lying to his father. He's saying there that his wife killed the kids and so he had to attack her, you know, and he's actually laying down the groundwork for a confession that goes along that way. But, you know, it's totally the opposite end to what really happened. But his father has to sit there and not give judgment. So he's just there to support his son, Chris. But you can tell that there is so much more to come, and we will get to it, I promise. Mm.
Yes, well, we don't want to spoil that, so we'll come back to that in a later episode. The next interview is with the brother of Stephen Paddock, the Las Vegas shooter who killed at least 50 people before turning the gun on himself. This is a live-to-air interview on KTNV Las Vegas the following morning.
An asteroid just landed on us and on Las Vegas, as far as we are concerned. We have no idea.
Does your brother live there or here? Or what?
This is all in the public record. He lived in Mesquite.
Okay.
He had a girlfriend.
Okay.
He gambled at the casinos. He called his mother.
Ever any indication at all that this was...
Nothing. That we're lost. I don't understand. It makes... There's no anything.
Was he... Describe the brother you know. Describe the man you know.
He's a guy. He's just a guy who lived in Las Vegas and played at the casinos, went on cruises, did stuff. There's nothing. That's what's bizarre. I mean, I don't even want to say, but he lived in a house. He had a girlfriend. There's nothing.
Is there anything going on in his life?
As far as we know, there's nothing. I mean,
when was the last time you talked to him?
He texted me after the hurricane when we lost power for 5 days to ask how my mom was. I mean, there's nothing. We're dumbstruck. She's pretty freaked out.
Yeah.
Well, strangely enough.
The number of guns, the firearms that he had, does that surprise you?
I mean, yes. I have no idea that he would have that many firearms.
Do you have a military background?
No. And I don't want to talk much more. This is all, once again, what I'm telling you is all part of the record. There's no, he has no police record. He doesn't even have parking tickets, probably.
How did you hear that he was?
We got phone calls to Las Vegas PD. We're cooperating with the cops. We have talked to the PD. This is like you called me up and said, your next door neighbor did this. And I go, wow, my next door neighbor did that. All I've ever seen him do is mow his yard. The fact that my brother did this is, there's nothing. I mean, there's absolutely no. We don't understand. Once again, this is all simple public record stuff.
If you could, once again, your message to these people, these families.
I there's not even anything I can say. I mean, how do you? I mean, my brother did this. This is like it was done, you know, like he shot us.
This man is in shock. He's really living a nightmare.
Yeah, and it's just horrible that they put the family in, you know, camera straight on their face just to get that first word, you know. And the last question was the worst thing, and it's asked so often, you know, what does the family want to say to other victims? It's like they are to blame. That why didn't they fix this man before he went and did this? And this brother says this. He goes, he was like the guy next door. He was friendly. He was nice. He asked about mum. You know, this is what I keep saying over and over again in this podcast, is that killers don't look different. They don't act differently. They are part of society. Yeah. And you don't know, especially with a mass killing like this, it is such an explosive act that often there may be some planning, but it takes that final moment where that they sink or swim. I mean, we did Roof a couple of weeks ago, and he sort of said, you know, I tried here and I went to the shopping center and it just didn't work. Then I went to the church and did it. And this is what we get. And these poor families have to sort of deal with this. And they don't know anything until the police ring them and say that shooting event was your brother and he's now dead. So they have the grief of losing someone that they love, as well as him being responsible for this horrific crime. And they're always asked to say something to other victims. These people are victims as well, and it's unfair to try and get a scoop on something when you're not going to get anything. They're not going to go, yeah, you know what, he's been shooting people for 50 years. It's not going to happen. But the news stories want to get that shock. And this guy's face is just horrifying. As you said, he's living a nightmare.
Well, next we head to a case very close to home, the massacre in Christchurch perpetrated by Aussie Brenton Tarrant in March 2019. Tarrant live-streamed the massacre of Muslim worshippers in the New Zealand city. Channel 9 News in Sydney spoke to Tarrant's grandparents the day after.
We're all gobsmacked. We don't know what to think. It's, you know, the media's saying he's planned it for a long time, so he's obviously not of sound mind, I don't think.
Amanda, saying he isn't of sound mind, that's probably the easiest way for families to actually comprehend what's happened, right?
Yeah, absolutely true. You know, we can try to dismiss abhorrent acts by assuming the person is crazy or they're incapacitated somehow. There are some that, you know, they were on drugs, that they've blamed antidepressants for Columbine and things like that. It would be easy for us to pigeonhole these people, saying only people who are crazy do these sorts of acts. But the opposite is true. These people are of sound mind. You know, going back to Cruz, you know, he was shocked by his own actions. Roof, that we did a few weeks ago, said, I'm halfway through and thought, what am I doing? And he wanted to stop, but he just didn't know how to, you know. But Tarrant is different, because we saw how well planned he had done this. That those that have seen the tape, you know, he had all that graffiti all over his weapons, you know, 88 Heil Hitler, which we learned after the event. And there's all these different parts of this, especially the live streaming, that takes this case to a higher level of cruelty. So the family does want to think he's crazy, but we will soon see that, you know, his grandma loved him like she probably does all of her grandchildren.
Well, the interview continues, and the reporter uses words like normal and happy before Terrence's grandmother again speaks.
It's just so much for everything to take in that somebody in our family would do anything like this. Spent most of his time on computers and learning all the ins and outs of computers and playing games on computers. But I don't think girlfriends were on the agenda. He said getting married was too hard.
It's interesting, isn't it, how his grandmother speaks fondly of him as she jokes about his younger years.
Well, this is what they often try to do, is they want to separate the man that perpetrated these crimes with the child that they knew. So they want to say that there's nothing about their upbringing that created that. And it's true. I mean, there is people that we've seen that were horribly abused, passed from foster home to foster home. There is all of that sort of stuff. There's the acceptance that Berkowitz and Bundy had to have about their real parentage. And there is those sort of moments that do create that perfect storm. But it's more of a coping mechanism for other families to say, well, we thought he was normal. He was no different to his other, you know, cousins. And they do this to try and create that break, because they don't want to think that the person who did that is who they know. So they cope by distancing themselves of the person he became.
Well, his grandmother then attempts to reconcile the murders with the ongoing Islamophobia across the globe. More from the Nine News report.
It's only since he travelled overseas, I think, that that boy has changed completely to the boy we knew.
Investigators believe Tarrant had been planning his attacks for 2 years whilst living in New Zealand. But 12 months ago, he returned to Grafton for his sister's birthday, and there were no red flags.
It was just his normal self, you know. We all chatted and that sort of thing and had a meal together to celebrate that occasion. And now everybody's just devastated.
His uncle then discusses how they found out what Tarrant had done by watching TV, like the rest of the world.
First up, I said, nah, couldn't be. Couldn't be, but then I saw in his favour. What he's done...
Yes.
It's just not right.
It's unrepairable.
Both of them, they're shaking their heads many times. There's disbelief, there's shock, but there is something missing, isn't there?
Well, yeah, there is no hatred, and that's why I wanted to do this episode. These people still love the person that they knew. So it's almost like that there's a double loss. So though they now know that their family is now linked to such a heinous crime forever, but they have lost that person as well. So it's not just about all of the deaths. It's about essentially the death of their loved one. I mean, Tarrant survived, as we know, and most of them did, except for the Las Vegas shooter. So, you know, they can hate what they did, but they don't hate the person. So, you know, and it's good to see that, you know, the love is unwavering and is unconditional. You know, they can be hurt, they can be shocked, that and there could be hatred, though there's none here. But that love does continue. You know, like I said, they hate the act but not the person.
Well, like many interviews with family members of killers, they are asked what they would say to the victims.
We say sorry for the families over there, for the dead and the injured. Yeah, we just can't think nothing else. Just want to go home and hide.
Shattered.
Yes, shattered is the word.
Must be so hard for them, Amanda.
Well, it is, and during that interview, the grandmother even says that she hasn't been able to contact Tarrant's mum because they've had to go into hiding because of the retribution that they thought may come, because there is people who will know who Tarrant's family is, because yes. they, these people aren't isolated. They have friends. They, you know, he certainly had a Facebook. We know that. So, you know, this is about that butterfly effect, and I think it is always cruel that a family has to say something to the victims. I don't think they should have to. I don't believe that they need to give a public apology purely because someone in their family did such a heinous crime. That person needs to give apologies, if nothing else, but the family does not need to.
It's an interesting thing you bring up, because it is a question all families are asked, and, you know, is there a level of responsibility thrown on these people for not seeing that there was a killer in the family?
By seeing the shock that these people are exhibiting, it shows that they didn't know that this was going to happen. This isn't something that you go into their bedroom and, like we see on TV, and they've got all the maps all up and, you know, they've got pinpoints of what they're going to do and what their plan is. They don't. They have, you know, some unusual traits maybe, but it's not like we can go, well, if A, B and C happens, you know, we're going to get a school shooter. If that was the case, we would never have them. So the families cannot be responsible. Yeah, if the parents have been sexually abusing this guy for 12 years and then he goes and shoots them dead, I totally get that. But these families, like this grandmother, shouldn't have to apologise to the New Zealand people because of what her grandson did. That is horrible and cruel.
Yeah, look, I agree. Next, we head to a case that, Amanda, you know the killer.
Yeah, now this is actually a hard one, and there will be a lot of people that won't agree with me here. But, you know, Elmer Wayne Henley, known as Wayne, was a serial killer, but I also believe he is a victim. Now, we're going to do this case as well in the near future, actually. But what we have here is the final part of the case. So what happened is that Henley, after an argument with fellow killer Dean Call, actually shot him dead. So Call had said to him, well, if you don't like what's going on, kill me, and he did. Now, Wayne and another accomplice, David Brooks, who had been procuring victims for Call before Henley was brought in, Henley was first supposed to be a victim, but he seemed to have more traits that Call liked. So, as I said, finally, Wayne actually stood up to Call and he shot the man dead.
Well, after ringing the police, he rang his mother. Here is that call.
Mama.
Who's this?
It's Wayne.
Yes, this is Mama, baby.
Mama?
Yeah?
I killed Dean.
Wayne?
Ma'am?
Wayne, you didn't?
Yes.
Oh, God. Where are you?
It's all right.
Wayne?
It's all right. It's all right.
Where are you?
I'm out of his warehouse.
Where?
Out at that warehouse, E.T.
Can I come out there?
Yes. No.
Is Elaine Clark?
She can't. No, you can't come. I'm with the police, Mama.
Now, that is a really strange call. And, you know, even for how brief it is, you know, his mum sort of says, who is it kind of thing. And, like, this is her son, who actually said mama, you know, like it's not like it was some sort of strange teleconference, you know, but she didn't really ask him how or why. So when Wayne actually says, I killed Dean, she's shocked and sad and wants to cry, but it's really odd that at the same time she's sort of very distant from it. But it's weird that she didn't want to know details. But then, you know, she gets that instinct that comes in and she wants to protect her son and ask where he is and what she can do to be with him. So, you know, for a 17-year-old kid, he's actually very calm about what has just occurred. And, you know, this is one of the most horrifying cases in US history. And it's just quite shocking that we actually get to this point purely because one of the killers actually kill the other killer. Now, this doesn't happen all that often. So when it does, it's just so strange. And the fact that this 17-year-old boy had to kill his co-killer is just, it's incomprehensible. And just the way that the mum responds to him, it's just quite odd.
I really have to say, Amanda, this case has piqued my interest.
Yeah, well, that's why we're going to do it soon. And for a shameless plug, I actually have pieces from the case. I've got some original photos and things like that in the museum, plus lots of correspondence from Wayne. But it's just, this case is just so different. It is, most people don't know about it, but they know about the John Wayne Gacy case that happened around the same time. So that was sort of a bigger case because there was more victims. But the Call, Henley and Brooks case, there is so many different branches of it that I can't wait to do it because it's just amazing and make your head spin.
All right, coming soon. Well, finally, we have the nephew of Robert Maudsley, a man who was called England's Hannibal Lecter, who was sent to prison for killing pedophiles. Here is what his nephew, Gavin, had to say about the killer when interviewed on British TV.
You love your family through thick and thin, as they say, you know. It doesn't matter what you've done, this is what you're saying when it's family. There's no sugarcoating that. There's not. He's a serial killer, yeah. But he's the only person to go into prison as a murderer, and he became a serial killer in jail.
What does that mean, the only person who became a serial killer in jail?
Well, what he's saying that he went to jail because he killed one person, then killed several more once he was in prison. We have about four serial killers in this country that have done that. So it's a very random statement to make, but I think it was more of a beat up just to show how horrific this killer was. But, you know, Gavin here is just showing that, as we said at the start of this, blood is thicker than water, and you love your family regardless of what's happened.
Well, Maudsley killed pedophiles, as you've just revealed. I mean, that's good, isn't it?
Yeah, true. I mean, it's hard to hate a man that actually is sort of killing the worst of the worst to most people. You know, people could think he should be, you know, president or something like that. but it's very different to how the crimes of Tarrant that we've just done. So there is a hatred there, but for Maudsley, though he gets his beat up as a cannibal and all of that, people still don't hate him as much purely because of who he chose as his own victims.
All right, Maudsley's nephew Gavin explains what life was like in the Maudsley household.
Me dad said, for some reason, it's as if the waste was reserved for Robbie. Like the granddad just didn't like Robbie for some reason, you know. And although they all had a bad time and a rough time, it's like Robbie got the waste. I believe there was one time he came into the room with an air rifle cocked and he broke the air rifle across Robert's back, hit him across the back with it and broke the air rifle.
Amanda, let me ask you this. Is childhood abuse an excuse for becoming a murderer?
Yes and no. I mean, this is that age-old question about nature versus nurture. There is so many people in this world that have had a life of abuse, sexual, mental, physical. It doesn't mean that they're actually going to become a killer. But what it does is it lays one of those foundation stones. So if a person is raised in a house of violence, is always treated poorly, sees that there is more violence towards them than the rest of the family, we do see them sometimes explode. I mean, Ed Kemper is a perfect example. His mother treated him horribly,
yes,
and then sent him away. And it's almost exactly the same with the Maudsley case. And he sort of had this hatred. I mean, the other killer I think of is Carl Panzram, who did the same thing. He said, I grew up in violence, that I sort of took that violence into the world and killed as many people as I could purely because I had a hatred for everyone in the world.
Well, Gavin then explains how and when Maudsley became a killer.
He's run away to London, met some guy. The guy showed him pictures, supposedly, of a girl that he was abusing. And my uncle freaked out, killed him. Went to the police station, handed himself in. There was no manhunt. And he said, I've just killed a sex offender. Here I am. Now will you help me?
It's interesting, isn't it? You said earlier that there would be some thought of making him the mayor of London.
I mean, yeah. I mean, it's not funny that he has killed someone, but this guy actually showed him the proof that he had been abusing this young girl. And Maudsley, knowing violence is one of his only answers and the only way he can express himself, he killed the guy and he had instant remorse. He went and handed himself in. But he was also grateful for, you know, that he had this sense of violence and the only way to take it out was on someone who probably deserved it. So, you know, I would have made him mayor as well, probably.
Do you know what? It's interesting, though, that if he kills one pedophile in jail, you might think, there's a problem here. He killed four. So you wonder whether authorities allowed him to be near pedophiles. That's all I'm saying. Gavin explains how he found out about his uncle's crimes.
My dad didn't know where Robert was, and it was only reading the papers that he learned that Robert had killed someone. I knew he was in prison and he'd done wrong, but it was never explained to me when I was a child what he had done, for obvious reasons. And it was when I was around maybe 12, 13 years of age. I was in senior school. One of my friends in class was reading maybe the Daily Mirror or something like that, and there was a double spread, Cannibal Maudsley, or Britain's Hannibal Lecter, with the story, and there was a photograph of him. And I do look like my uncle in this photograph. And one of my friends said, "Hey, who's this Maudsley fella? Is he related to you?" And I knew straight away then that that was my Uncle Bob. So I was able to read that newspaper article and really get to grips with what he had done and learn the details of it. And it was only then that I've gone back and spoke to my mum that I've seen this in the paper about Uncle Bob, blah, blah, blah. And that's when I was to find out exactly what had happened.
Wowzers. But it's not uncommon for families to keep things like this a secret, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, I remember one time, it was probably about 15 years ago, a young girl contacted me because she had read one of my books, and in the book was the Anita Cobby killing. And she actually said to me, "Look, I'm a niece of her and my family won't talk about it and it's a bit hush-hush, so can you sort of walk me through it all, you know, without the gratuitous violence, but just to explain what happened?" She goes, "Because it's something that no one will talk about." So it's interesting to find these people that are linked to these cases. Mm. And as we said, it often affects the family quite grossly, but here we have a couple of people who sort of had to read a newspaper or had to read a book to understand what had happened to someone. And so then once it comes out, and, you know, if Gavin had gone to his family and said, like, "What the fuck," there might have been a different conversation. But he read it all and went, "Okay, so this is what happened." And so the family were quite open and were able to sort of explain it in a calm way, that it wasn't shame, especially when he was killing pedophiles. But the fact that, yes, he was in prison and it's not a bad thing, but it is a bad thing, but, you know, you can accept it a bit more.
Mm. Well, Gavin then explains what it's like to know your uncle is known as Hannibal Lecter.
He's my special uncle, because I've got no other uncle that I could compare to him in any kind of way, you know. You know, all my other uncles are just my uncles, you know. Whereas Uncle Bob, he's done these crazy things and stuff like that, and there's this big story surrounding him, and that in itself puts a bit of a cloud over the family. But I'm trying to move that cloud, because for too many years it's been like that. And, you know, you've been through all that pain. So let's just enjoy what we've got together.
Geez, it must be hard having an infamous name. Like here the name Malak piques people's interest. Bundy, Gacy, Dahmer. Names can create issues for those who are innocent but are linked nonetheless.
Oh, it does. And there has been people I've spoken to, because I'm one of those weird people who hears a surname and I'll ask, "Are you related?" And I know I'm not the first person to ask, and I certainly won't be the last to ask them. But some of them go, yeah, you know, Uncle Ivan or something like that. But most of them, if they have an issue, actually change their name. So I know that the daughter of the Happy Face killer actually changed her surname purely because her husband, her father, Jesperson, actually said to her, "Your surname is going to ruin your life. Change it," you know. Yeah. But here we have a guy saying, "Yeah, Uncle Bob, yeah, he's Hannibal Lecter." And there was almost a bravado about it. So it's a very different response, but it just shows that they are accepting sometimes of their family. They can hate what they've done, but they don't hate the person.
Mm. Very interesting. Well, Amanda, this was a really fascinating case of stories, I've got to say, in a very different angle. I really liked this one. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it was very interesting, and I'm glad we could do it.
Yeah, we'll see you next week on Monsters Who Murder, Serial Killer Confessions.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime.
Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.